Hello, dear listener, and welcome back to Flight Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast where the world ends if we do dance. I'm Nathan.
I'm Brendan.
And I'm just back from up the butcher's where he's really been extending the mince.
Sausage casing.
So we've spent a week trapped in a dingy hospital ward, surviving only on Bex and back rubs, so must be time.
I miss Medicare.
It must be time for us to finally get round to confronting this slowly advancing army of gas mask wearing zombies. Welcome at last.
To Brexit.
No. To the Doctor Dances.
Left-wing jokes in there,
yes,
I'm not sure.
Already, well, yes.
Not quite as much left-wing stuff as the actual story gets in, because
we get Tony Benn cited by Don't Forget the Welfare State.
So last week, and we didn't mention it, the Doctor suggested that Nancy's little group of street urchins stealing food from the rich was kind of Marxism in action. Mm. And then this time we get, you know, the great post-war achievement of Britain, which was the welfare state. The fact that people in Britain had learned that they were kind of all on the same side, despite the massive sort of class divides, you know, that plague and continue to plague Britain. There was a kind of mentality of pulling together and a kind of understanding that misfortune is... it's not something that happens to you because you're particularly feckless or wicked or lazy, but just that you're unlucky. And so the great post-war project of the welfare state, and you get we've had a little bit of sort of left-wingery sneaking its way into the season so far with this very working-class doctor, but I think Moffat is the one who really kind of makes it explicit in his story.
It's funny saying this. For the time it was written, it's only 13 years ago, but it's before even the UK had gay marriage. And it was just after the first attempt at it had been defeated here by both major parties.
Yeah.
It
is worth mentioning. Let's not forget that.
And absolutely rammed through Parliament in a very, very fast measure to put us in our place.
Yeah,
still bitter. But it takes one of the few straight members of the production team, because of course the production team was headed up by two gay men and
the
a heterosexual
person.
Woman, you know. I say that, you know, Mal Young was an executive producer, but even Mal Young said, you know, my job was to sort of smooth relations between a BBC in-house production, which we hadn't really done in a long time, and the BBC. He wasn't a creative force on the show. He was an administrative force. But, you know, Russell T. Davies said at the time, we've got me, we've got Mark Gatiss, we've got Phil Collinson, but it's Stephen Moffat who comes in and puts in all the gay characters. And I think it's very important that we have someone like Stephen Moffat who, you know, he is kind of a definition of someone who has all the privilege in the world. You know, he is relatively well off in a country where he can be successful in a creative role. He is a heterosexual white man, and he chooses in his texts to put in strong female characters, strong queer characters. He writes
Scottish characters.
Weak Scottish characters. You know, he writes in people from societally disadvantaged backgrounds and gives them power and agency.
I think what's interesting here is too that none of the movies that we said that this was referencing would have been able to have been quite so explicit about the existence of gay people as this is. And last
week, they
didn't
exist.
Well, yeah, that's right. We weren't there. And it's the same conversation that we end up having in Thin Ice with Bill about non-white characters in the past. And it's great that Moffat does this. And one of the things, like, people I think correctly identify sometimes that Moffat's writing can be a bit problematic. But I have absolutely no doubt that his heart is in the right place. Mm-hmm. And you can see during the course of his tenure on Doctor Who mm-hmm. that he learns in his first season of Doctor Who there aren't any gay characters. And then he goes, actually, that's a real oversight.
Mm-hmm.
And here he gets to do a good gay character or a couple of good gay characters in Algy and Jack and then the evil Mr. Lloyd who has been exchanging, you know, pork for...
Pork.
Or for crackling.
If I may jump in there, I've had a bit of a journey with this story because when it was first on, it was my favourite of the entire season. And it is now my favourite of the entire season as well. But over the course of the last 13 years, I did actually go off it a bit. And it mm-hmm. was because of the character of Mr. Lloyd and because Nancy threatens to expose his queerness yeah. in order to get what she wants. And also that's played for comedy, yeah. which I objected to. But looking at it, it's like, well, no, this is accurate for the time.
And he is a hypocrite.
And he is a hypocrite, absolutely.
Yeah. And exceeding his bounds. He's taking more than his fair due.
Yes, yes.
And I really think that's the impetus for it, not any form of...
No, absolutely. Not, and that's the conclusion yes. I came to as well. It's like, well, hold on. This is both accurate to the time, but also no one threatens Algy in that way.
Indeed.
You know, so it's not a punishment of queer characters. It's a punishment of an ignoble character.
Yes.
And also something I didn't pick up until I was watching this week, when he's talking about, I pay for the food on this table, the sweat on my brow, that is. Yeah. That's the sweat on my brow. And I thought, yes, I'm sure it is, even if you're in the cool room, dear.
Nancy gets a great callback to that because, of course, he's sweating at the threat. And just as she leaves, she just says, there you go. There's the sweat on your brow.
Yeah, yeah, it's yeah.
Beautiful.
I think if we want representation, I think that we have to get to be villains. I think yes. that we have to get to be ignoble and cowardly and selfish.
And human.
If we're only that, then that's a problem.
Absolutely. There's been a discussion recently in making video games mm-hmm. because video games are starting to include more queer characters as well, because video games as a storytelling narrative are often behind film simply because the story usually takes a backseat to, say, gameplay, you mm-hmm. know, and how the game actually plays. But there's a very famous video game called The Last of Us, which is about two characters, a man and sort of an adopted surrogate daughter figure in the first game. In the second game, this character, Ellie, I believe she's called, is going to be a stronger lead character. And also they've introduced that she is a lesbian and she's having a relationship with another woman. And that prompted an author on Kotaku, the website, to write an article entitled "Let Queer Characters in Games Be Happy." And the author then cites all these examples of queer characters in games who come to a sticky end.
It's kill your gaze. It's
yeah,
a trope.
Exactly. And the point she makes towards the end is, of course, queer characters can die as any character can die, because if you have queer characters being immortal in games,
yes.
there is no tension of whether they will survive. It would just be nice if some did.
Mm.
And I think that's a very important point.
Mm.
We need to be able to be villains and to have bad things happen to our characters, so long as that's not the only thing.
Yeah.
Because when Stephen Moffat does eventually introduce two gay characters, they're the fat, thin, gay atheists, why would we need names? And one of them is killed, and his yes. partner never finds out. And it's just like,
yes.
yeah, yeah. And then he does better later down the line.
Yes.
Culminating in Bill, obviously.
Yeah, yeah. The last main character that Stephen Moffat introduces is a lesbian of colour.
Yeah.
he comes full circle, yeah. yeah. But yeah, that's kind of been my journey with this story of going, oh, actually, that's a bit horrible, to, well, that means that this character of Mr. Lloyd, he's got, what, two or three scenes? But we find out so much about him. Is he actually queer? Or mm-hmm. is he just, you know, doing it for the pork, as
Day
it were? Yeah. Is his wartime sacrifice?
Fine. That defense always a little treacly and nebulous, really.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, it raises mystery about his character, whereas we're told in no uncertain terms in the story that algae exclusively goes for men.
Yeah, so there's that distract the guards moment. And, of course, Rose, who has watched plenty of genre TV, knows that that's her job. And she goes off to distract the guard. And, of course, Jack says, no, you're really not his type. And he goes off to distract him.
So she has a real moment of this is just not clicking.
The funny thing about Rose's reaction in that is it shows, and I think it's deliberate, it mm-hmm. shows, despite her intelligence and her resourcefulness, Rose is quite a naive character.
Mm.
The idea of bisexuality shocks and surprises her. She's
quite young.
Yeah, so. But she's got this kind of look on her face, but he was flirting with me. How can he now be flirting with her?
Yes.
And we'll also see next season, and even later on this season, that she finds the idea of the Doctor relating to anyone else the way he relates to her. She finds that very confusing and hurtful.
Yes, yes. So, as you do when you're young.
Absolutely. Yes. You know, this is my relationship. How can that relationship exist elsewhere?
Yes.
And it's very well played by Billy. Some people have quoted it as like a character oversight, but it's like, no, I think that is the character.
Yes.
This is her first true love.
I think, too, that there is a very definite attempt to, like, contrast the three time zones that our characters are from in so far as their kind of sexual mores are concerned. And it's a little bit like the unearthly child. Not the empty child, an unearthly child, where you
That's
have
a very harsh criticism of Carol Ann.
Well, she hasn't even had a sandwich, you know. Take a drink.
You know how you get the Doctor who's from the far future, Barbara and Ian who are from the present, and then the Tribe of Gum who are from, you know, 100,000 BC. Here you get the people from the 1940s with their sexual ethics. Then you get Billy, you get Rose, who's from 2005 with her sexual ethics, and then you get Jack from the 51st century, and it is a story.
With his Magnus Greal ethics. he just picks his bints out of a rotisserie, doesn't he?
Yeah, gosh. Like, it turns out Todd was right all along. Why was Magnus Greal not picking up young men and putting them in the machine? he and Jack are from the same century, and we've got a much more sort of enlightened and permissive attitude towards who we're prepared to dance with.
Well, he was the Butcher of Brisbane. Maybe he's a descendant of Lyle Shelton.
Yeah, that's
Ooh, it. Banktish.
Which would involve anyone descending with Lyle Shelton.
At a great distance. Is this the point where I can get all fanboyish and say, I don't understand how the Sigma Particle Experiments, which wound up its own fundament, hello, algae, possibly have anything to do with Jack? Why were they picking 51st century? Simply because we could just do another casual nod as a long-time viewers.
I think we've said
As in insane fanboys, i.e.,
Well, I think we've said before that Russell tries to get out of the way of Doctor Who continuity by setting everything in the sort of 2001st century or in the year 5 billion or whatever, and they haven't wanted to go quite so far ahead. And Magnus Greal does talk about time agents.
He does believe the Doctor is a time agent. Yeah. You're damn right. But so was I'm so sorry to do this to you. But I know you're itching as much as I am. And it's not just the dogs on the sofa, of whom we have two lovely ones here, and Nathan and Brendan. So their Sigma experiments were going on parallel but discreetly from main time, and that maybe Greal was looking to be another Elon Musk, because that can only go well.
Yeah, I think that he thought that it was rather day class A to travel through time with a watch, and he wanted to find a way of traveling through time in a Chinese lacquer cabinet. And that took a lot more Sigma energy than the watches did, you see. So I think it all fits in very nicely.
That beautifully. Now you've explained it, I can say. I don't know how I could have been so foolish not to have seen it,
I think also Magnus Greal is based on Earth, whereas Jack implies several times he's been to other planets and other times. But in terms of the continuity, they had a very difficult job this year in that they had to appease fans by stating, you know, this is the same series, it is a continuation. Mm. So if they're going to refer back to something, they need to make damn sure they've got it right. So if the script includes references to time agents, it doesn't surprise me at all that someone, whether it was Moffat or whether it was Russell, would say, okay, in that case, then Jack is from the 51st century, mm-hmm. and that way we can tie it in. And it's the kind of continuity reference that we will get, but the audience won't feel, the general audience won't feel that they've missed something.
No, they won't notice that it's a reference any more than the sort of stuff about the Aesop galaxy or Venom Grubs.
No, exactly. Yeah. And, yeah, I think it's the same reason that a few weeks ago we had a 60s, 70s cyber head in the museum, because it's like, what kind of cyber stories got the largest amount of viewers?
Yeah,
kind
what
of thing.
Do people remember?
What do people remember?
Like.
And so fans will go, oh, well, that's a head from The Invasion. Whereas casual viewers will go, oh, I think I watched that with my dad. Tom Baker, I remember that one. Yeah, they had flares. Yeah, so I think this year they tread very deftly with continuity. And I remember being terribly excited when I could spot a reference. You know, and even all these 13 years later, I still only just catch the reference to the Aesop galaxy in The Long Game.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, there's one in Bad Wolf as well, but there's one in The Long Game on one of the news channels.
Right, right.
The face of Bo is referred to as being from the Aesop galaxy.
Yes, beautiful.
So, as always, I think we should get back to the topic of sex. So, the Doctor dances. It's obviously an oblique way to talk about the Doctor having sex. The world doesn't end if the Doctor dances. And this season, we've talked about that show Bible before, where Russell says that he doesn't want the Doctor to be that neutered public schoolboy.
Mm-hmm.
So, the Doctor very clearly, I think, this season sort of comes out as heterosexual in a more explicit way than he has before, and perhaps a less explicit way than he will next year, I think, with Billy. And we've always had Pat flirting with the female guest stars. Tom desperately trying to put his hands on Judith Paris.
Threw up a roll of cyclone fencing and it still didn't stop him,
But here we have, you know, like this season we've had people ask about whether the Doctor and Rose have a sexual relationship. We have the Doctor kind of going on a date with Jabe. And here we do get the question of whether the Doctor has sex.
Yeah.
And I think associated with that is it's the first reference ever to the Doctor shaving. As well.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Although he had a shaving mirror, as we know.
Yes.
That's true. Yeah.
In the secondary console.
Yes. Yes.
Which Pertwee used between season 10 and 11 when he asked Victoria to travel with him again in one of the Decalogues, I believe it was.
Oh.
I'm a very passionate person.
You have my entire attention.
What I really love and adore about that scene where the Doctor and Rose are trapped in that cupboard waiting for Jack to rescue them is just the Doctor's hurtness and defensiveness that Rose assumes that he doesn't have desires and passions and loves.
Mm.
You know, he has referred to the fact that he's lost everyone. And so we get the implication here that he may have lost someone he loves. And Christopher Eccleston, of course, didn't do as many interviews as his successors would do about the role. But one thing he said about his interpretation of the character that has always stuck with me is he said, the Doctor's a Time Lord and Time Lords have two hearts, which means they can both be broken.
Oh.
It brings back that melancholy that Sylvester McCoy so often brought into the character. And, you know, the Doctor seems quite hurt that Rose would just assume that he doesn't have this element to his life.
Yes.
And it's possible that the reason he presents himself that way, and I think the Doctor's kind of thinking about that here, hold on, is that what I've shown you that I can't love? And yeah, well, it kind of is, because you've been pushing away love and affection. Like when Jabe reaches out to him, he doesn't say anything.
I think also it's about the Doctor not being that sort of matinee idol hero that Jack is.
Mm-hmm.
So Jack is very definitely presented as someone who dances, you know. And he is handsome. He dances on the top of his ship. He gives champagne to Rose, you know, all of that. He's sort of sexy. And she's been complaining that the Doctor isn't a proper hero. At the very opening of last week's episode, she talks about how they never leave Earth and they nip back for milk. And and there's nothing sort of particularly glamorous or sexy or techie about the Doctor. He's a little bit sort of ramshackle.
Mm-mm-mm.
And she says, you know, give me some Spock, scan Fralian tech, do something really cool and science fiction-y. Then Jack comes along, and Jack is beating the Doctor. The Doctor's kind of being cucked a bit by Jack at this point. And Jack comes along, and he's dashing, and he's got a big gun, and he makes fun of the Doctor's tiny sonic screw. and, you know, talks about how stupid it is, and the Doctor's visibly embarrassed about his screwdriver.
Yeah, and he struggles to sort of justify the screwdriver. He's like, haven't you ever been bored or had a lot of cabinets to put up? I get the impression there that the Doctor suddenly thinks, actually, why do I have this? Why did I choose a screwdriver? Going all the way back to the very beginning last week when the Doctor says it's like a mauve alert. And even Rose is like, that's not proper. It's red alert. The Doctor's like, only by your standards, you know. It's all about, as we've been talking about, it's the different mores and customs. And, you know, the Doctor can kind of walk in and observe the customs of someone else, but he doesn't necessarily take them on board. Whereas Jack does nothing to hide his 51st century sensibilities. You know, when he flirts with Algy, Algy enjoys it, but he's, you know, he's very worried and concerned about being found out. Yeah, he's a little shocked by Jack's forwardness.
Yeah.
There's this undercurrent with the sexuality in this story that it's kind of like, it's a period of war. They don't think they're going to get out of this. Mm. You know, Nancy even says, what future? Mm. Hold on, if you're a Londoner from the future, how come you sound English? Why aren't you German? Mm. They don't think that they're going to win this. So it's like, I've been kind of a good boy all my life. You can imagine Algy thinking, I've been a good boy all my life and gone for the girls. Well, I'm going to be dead next week. So no, I like boys. I'm not going to shout it from the rooftops because I feel like I can't, but I'm going to bloody indulge. And, you know, Mr. Lloyd, if he is enjoying his trips to the butchers, he's going, well, this is the time for it. Nancy, 5 years ago, as a teenager, has obviously fallen for someone who said he would be there. In the original draft of the script, Jamie's father was in the story.
Right.
And pretty much he was this mysterious figure who was helping Nancy from the periphery. Mm. So, you know, he might scout out the building and call Nancy in. And that was then streamlined for two reasons. One, it's like, why do you need that character? Yes. Nancy gets to be the one who goes in. But two, it lends that degree of ambiguity of, okay, did he abandon Nancy? Was he a soldier? Did he have to go off and fight? Was he a much older man? Did he already have a family? And was this going on? We're not given any of that information.
I think it is eventually made clear that she was very young.
Yes.
And, like, if he'd gone off and been killed, she wouldn't have had to say that Jamie was her brother. And the thing that has got us into this mess, that has got us into this whole gas mask zombie mess, is the sexual ethics prevalent in the 1940s. Yes. And if Jamie had known that Nancy was his mother,
consciously,
then
yes.
The Chula ambulance thing wouldn't have made the mistakes that it did.
Yes.
And it's only rectified where she's able to stand up and say, I am your mother. This is a kid who has never known who his mother is. He doesn't know who his mother is. He's got a big sister. Mm. But because it's outrageous and impossible for her to stand up and say, yes, I wasn't married, but this is my son, just as it would be impossible for Mr. Lloyd to stand up and say, that butcher's hot, I'm leaving Mrs. Lloyd for him. Or Algy can't come out either. All of this sort of oppressive mid-20th century sexual morality is the problem here. And the solution to it is...
It's not the bombs, dear.
No. Right. The solution is the 51st century sexual morality that Jack brings to the table.
Or the couch, or, yeah.
The top deck.
Sofa of extreme comfort.
Well, I mean, Moffat wrote, joking apart, is like a really kind of slightly embarrassing sex comedy. It predates coupling, which is slightly less embarrassing sex comedy. But, you know, Moffat, that's where Moffat made his name in TV. Mm. And it's nice for the first time, I think, to have a Doctor Who story that comments on sexual ethics as a central part of its sort of thematic architecture.
Again, it links back to the Sylvester McCoy era. And the interesting thing was when the series was being publicised, before it came back, Russell T Davies had said in an interview when he was talking about the tone of the series, oh, you know, we're looking back to older eras of the show, like the Hinchcliffe era. And some tabloids, and I believe I mentioned this back in Rose, some tabloids then picked that up as the series is going to carry on from season 14 and ignore everything that came afterwards, and it's a semi-reboot. And Russell then had to come out and give an interview and say, no, I love all eras of Doctor Who. And he even cited, for instance, a lot of people think the last 3 years of Doctor Who were terrible with Sylvester McCoy. But we are building on that a lot. We have a character who's from London, and he even said, we probably wouldn't be able to do this without the groundwork that Sylvester McCoy and Sophie Aldred had laid. Because I remember then Sophie Aldred said in an interview, they're talking about the stuff we did and saying it's an antecedent of what they're doing, which is amazing. We didn't think anyone was watching, you know. Back in The Curse of Fenric, it starts introducing Ace's sexuality.
Yeah.
You know, there'd been hints beforehand. But again, that's the World War II setting. And the whole reason that Ace is able to seduce that guard is because she acts in a way contrary to how a woman would act.
Yes.
And of course, we have Kathleen being shocked at the idea that Audrey might be born out of wedlock.
Yeah, that's the same thing, isn't it? Where Ace just casually assumes that Kathleen's not married because she's young and like none of Ace's friends are married, probably. And then Kathleen's quite shocked by that.
Yeah, and shocked and offended.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not that kind of girl. And of course, we've got Mrs. Hardacre saying, you know, any expression of female sexuality is evil.
Because she was that kind of girl.
Yes. Yeah. That's the subtext there. Whereas here, people are set free by acknowledging, actually, this is a bit stupid. This is my son.
Yeah.
Yeah. That scene is so powerfully played because the realization leading up to the moment where the Doctor figures it all out, it's mostly played with looks. Mm-hmm. The monsters are all around saying, are you my mummy? Are you my mummy? And Nancy says, it's all my fault. And the Doctor says, how can it be your... And then it's just cutting between the zombies and the Doctor and Nancy and just their looks to each other. And then the Doctor spells it all out. Mm. And yeah, we praised her last week, but yeah, Florence Hoath puts in a great job again here. Mm. Now, I don't know exactly which scene it is, but there's one scene in this episode with Nancy, which was a filler scene. And for ages, I heard it was the scene with the typewriter, with one of the kids writing a letter to his dad, and then the child takes control of the typewriter. And I believe Stephen Moffat said in interviews, yes, I had to write that scene quite late, and that's why it doesn't make much sense, because the kid can control speakers. Yeah. Not any machine. How can he suddenly control a typewriter? Mm. But, you know, we had 2 minutes to fill.
It's also the same beat that he does earlier in the episode as well, where, which I think is fabulous, where they're playing the recordings of Dr. Constantine talking to Jamie when he first arrives in the hospital. And you hear him speaking, but you can hear this crackling sound. And it's really well directed because if you're paying attention, you actually know what's going on. The tape has reached its end and it's just making that sort of noise of a reel-to-reel tape going around and the sort of crinkly bit of tape hitting it. But the voices are still going. And then we suddenly realize that, in fact, the tape has reached its end and it's actually Jamie approaching, controlling the speaker.
Yep.
Now we have everyone's talking, the typewriter's still going, and then it turns out the kid's not typing any longer because it's Jamie approaching. So
yeah.
It does dilute that a bit. But the first version of it is so Moffat-y, so brilliantly Moffat-y and so scary.
Yeah. Especially Eccleston's reaction, because he plays it both as like utter fascination with what's happening, but slowly building terror, because he kind of goes, it's got the power of a god and I've sent it to its room. This is its room.
I think that he realizes what's going on too, because Rose nags him a couple of times about what the sound is, what that crackling noise is, and he ignores her.
Yeah, so I
think he knows that that's Jamie coming.
And, you know, then we get the whole thing with the banana.
You see, I think that's where the Doctor starts to win. I think that we had this sort of phase where Jack is the better hero than the Doctor because he's sort of sexier and more techie and has more Spock going, and the Doctor seems a little bit embarrassed. But then he's sort of surreptitiously stealing Jack's squareness gun and going back in time to destroy the place it comes from and replace it with a banana plantation. And, like, his sort of much sillier much less violent approach to being a hero.
Yeah, he wins because he's not a Yank, and the British will always side with their own. He's the George Formby in this comedy. If Jack is whomever you want to, Paul Heinrich, whomever you want to cast as the glamorous matinee idol. And, of course, the home counties always win.
Yeah.
But again, yes, we have no bananas. It's actually referencing that great war, which was a wartime hit.
Yes,
it's
yes, comedy yeah.
It kind of been easy to get bananas in London, actually, during.
They weren't around. They were doing ersatz bananas.
Made out of jackfruit and jack boots.
Stop it. And all the other bits of jack that weren't necessary at this precise moment for any other deeds. Yes. Yes. Every generation loves and seems to reboot when they come of age the period just when they were born. You know, which is why you tend to get fashion and theatre tropes and indeed aesthetics on a wider socialist level, sort of kind of spinning every 20 years. The 70s were very 1930s, 40s in film references and in clothes, of course, of that generation. We're seeing a bit of 80s, 90s redundancy now. Those kids, those poor children, and that's all they had.
That's all we left to revive.
And we were interested in the mod aspects and, well, Doctor Who. But this now, we also have that other point where that generation was starting to properly leave us, the very last of them. And there's a real heart burning of the great loss, and that had been in British films a long time, but it was really starting to come up. And it's interesting seeing it now. It's something of our Anzac, our own in Australia. We have the Anzac memory or the Anzac memorial, which has become, both in its physical presence and in its march each year, which has become something really quite extreme and not at all what it was when those diggers were still alive, which was, oh, yes, we honour them, but we don't make a fuss about it. Mm. It's no big thing. It's actually something, you know, there's a lot of shame in this. On every level, we'll just acknowledge quietly. And this was kind of the last beat of that before. I think you'll start to see, we mentioned it last week, but you'll start to see with Brexit coming that you'll be getting, I think, something a little bit bolderized and perhaps overweening in the 40s nostalgia that's about to come up. Mm-hmm. But this is a lovely point in between the two. And the films that we were just talking about and my pick of the week later on. So again, there's a lot to be thankful to Moffat for, to Mr. Stephen Moffat. He doesn't like being called Moffat, apparently. He's not a brand. Yeah. So, no, like Callan or you know, or Brute 33 or whatever it is. But it's a beautiful balancing act, this two-parter. And I was terribly excited at the time because I thought, oh, goody, we're getting back to four-parters again, being a loyal Big Finish listener. I can split this up and pretend it's four episodes.
It is four episodes, only without quite so much standing around cheaply in corridors.
How true.
Isn't it?
The thing is, there is still a bit of urgent standing in corridors and hospital wards, wow. You know, which, yeah, Stephen Moffat says, Doctor Who is about urgent standing in corridors.
It's about actors speaking to each other reading. It's theatre.
Yeah. I have to say, one of the sort of most heart-rending moments in this for me, it's the beginning of the redemption of Jack, because the whole thing is, yeah, okay, Jack is your matinee idol. He's the hero with the gun. He's the sexy one. He's Captain Kirk. But the situation starts to get out of control, and the situation for Jack gets out of control. And John Barrowman plays it really well. Again, it's all about looks, is when he approaches Algy, and Algy turns around and says, are you my mummy? And the look on Jack's face is heartbreaking, because until this point, you're kind of led to believe that as flirty as Jack is, he doesn't actually care about anyone. You know, it's all just a con. It's, you know, yeah, I go to Pompeii, but I get out before Volcano Day. You know, he doesn't care that all those people have died, but he likes Algy. And when he sees that happen to Algy and begins to realize that this is his fault, it's actually a really bittersweet moment. And I think it's the first time we see him show kind of genuine emotion that's not just about the con. Mm-hmm. And that's where his redemption begins. And he becomes so desperate to say, this isn't my fault, this isn't my fault, this isn't my fault. And when the doctor points out, well, actually, it's this. Yes. Again, he's horrified. And his only defense is, I didn't know.
Mm. Didn't stand up in The Hague.
No.
But I mean, but that is what prompts his actual redemption. So he gets kind of, the Doctor's winning at this point because he cares more and because he's more fun and more silly than Jack.
Mm.
And Jack realizes that he has to make it right in order to save everyone. So he gets to die heroically, like a sort of proper hero, in a way that's sort of immediately subverted. Mm. We get that wonderful Doctor Strange love moment.
Where he's sitting. God, yes. That was another filmic reference. It's beautiful.
I have heard somewhere that the script reads, Jack is sitting on the bomb, and they viewed it, I believe, in the original script, Russell T. Davies sort of saw him as, you know, he's sitting on it like a park bench. You know, he's sitting side saddle, as it were.
Well, it is Jack.
But apparently it was John Barrowman when he got into the studio. He just got astride it and they went, actually, there you go. That also gives us our Bad Wolf reference for this episode, because the bomb has on the side of it written, Schleichter Wolf. But the problem is the translation's really dodgy, and it actually translates to naughty wolf rather than bad. It's like
you crummy wolf.
you chose the wrong German word. It's like we have a very precise language, you know, it's this or this. Also, in that moment, and this is something that James has pointed out to me in the past, we start getting the strings from the Doctor Who theme in the incidental music. And at the time this episode went out, James's partner was a musician and DJ and wasn't big into Doctor Who, but loved the music of Doctor Who. And so James learned a lot about music as well. And because the Doctor Who theme is not owned by the BBC, it is licensed from, I believe, Warner Music owned the copyright.
Oh, really?
And that's why when this was coming on, and also with the telemovie, there was doubt as to whether they would be able to retain the theme.
Oh.
So in Murray Gold's theme arrangement, he introduces the strings as a counter melody, so he can use those in the incidental music, whereas using the actual sort of melody of the Doctor Who theme could incur, you know, an extra usage fee. He can use the bits he's introduced to the theme to link the incidental music to the theme and sort of make that, you know, this is the theme of when the Doctor starts to win. But that's also part of the reason that he will go on to develop themes for each Doctor and each character, because, you know, we know that that's I Am the Doctor, we know that that's Am I a Good Man, and that is the music for this character.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's when Jack is sitting on the bomb and we're getting the strings that are just lifted from the theme, but it's really effective because it ties that in. From another production standpoint, before we get to the ending, I love the cinematography and the light and the colouring in this story. It is so cold. It feels so cold. And the whole thing happens at night, you know, which is so rare. I don't think we've ever had a Doctor Who story with external filming that's been entirely at night. I think the closest, and it's not external, but things Wing like Chiang. The horror, Wang Chiang, horror Fang Rock happens in one night kind of thing. But yeah, there's so much external stuff happening here.
Happiness Patrol.
Something else I picked up on with the cinematography, it was last week, the two phone calls the Doctor gets, when the phone rings, the shots are framed in a similar way. So you've got the phone on one side of the screen, you've got the Doctor on the other side of the screen, you've got Nancy standing behind in the distance. And then, so the first one, the TARDIS phone is on the right, Doctor's on the left. Yeah. Second one, phone is on the left, Doctor's on the right. And also there's a Batman angle. Just to make you feel uneasy and make you feel strange.
Mm.
And speaking of that whole four-parter thing, the great thing is, if you were to divide last week's episode into two parts, the cliffhanger is when the Doctor opens the door for the child.
Oh.
And just imagine that as a cliffhanger. Doctor opens the door. You don't see what's on the other side of the door. Mm. Credits. And then the reprise. And then the solution is the kid's gone.
Mm.
It's a great falling action there. And that's another great moment for Eccleston. You know, he's been the child left out in the cold, which is a theme Stephen Moffat will run with the more he writes for the character. So he feels sympathy for this child.
Yes.
And, yeah, it's the Doctor's sort of detached curiosity that he always has. But at the same time, you know, he has to know and he has to save this child. And with the ending, as we get to it, we've had so much death this season and so much of other characters solving the problem. Like, I remember one story that came in for a lot of criticism at the time was The Long Game, because basically the Doctor is restrained during the whole denouement, and it's all down to him having inspired someone half an hour ago who then comes up and solves the problem. But here, yeah, the Doctor gets to do it instead. And
I think he inspires two people. He inspires Jack to go back and kind of fix the problem. Mm. And then he inspires Nancy to make her admission. And he's right there doing it. And he also gets to do some magic. You know, like he gets to do some
very Harry Potter effects.
Yeah. And I think that's very deliberate as well. You know, the Doctor doesn't solve things with guns. He solves things with magic. He's the Doctor.
He's the Maggie Smith of the production.
He, all along. Yeah.
You know, he's doing the accent.
Yes.
Like the nanogenes are established very clearly and mentioned a bunch of times in the first episode. Jack has the ability to take control of speakers. So all of this sort of stuff, because Moffat will create monsters that are whatever shape is needed for the plot. Mm. And people talk about Blink being sort of great, but Blink cheats horrifically by making the monsters be and do whatever he thinks will look cool and will serve the plot. And he brilliantly takes them out of context the following year and actually uses them for something else. But you couldn't take the Chula warship ambulance things out of context because they're completely dependent on whatever it is that the plot needs to happen or whatever visual set pieces we need, you know.
Yeah, hexachromite gas, lethal to reptile and marine life.
Yeah, we just have it hanging around, you know. But it does give us that fantastic moment, and it's maybe one of Eccleston's best moments in the series where just of excitement, just give me this one, just this once, everybody
we've
lives.
We've said that so many times in the past, haven't we, Mr. Saywood? We have.
And that's actually a whole go at Saywood, wasn't it?
The opposite of Resurrection of the Daleks.
You can see Janet Fielding sitting at home saying, I would have bloody stayed had they done that.
Even that woman's leg.
My leg's grown back and it wants to go to Heathrow. It's saying I've got a really horrible dress. And this
and it's
scene.
Got the greatest comedic throwaway line, which is so British comedy. Well, there is a war on.
That scene just made me so, so sad that Eccleston was going. Because you can see what Russell T. Davies was doing is he's like, we're going to do the Colin Baker thing. We're going to have a very long arc to get to know this character. And for God's sake, never say that. It never ends well.
No, it's so true, isn't it?
So, you know, this is obviously we're going to have sort of a year. And towards the end of that year is when he gets better and he starts being the Doctor and being, you know, the sort of happy figure the Doctor should be. And we're going to build up to that. And then, you know, in a few weeks, just to finish off, he is going to wipe out the Daleks once and for all. He's going to end the Time War. And, you know, then we'll go on to him, you know, being all chummy with Queen Victoria. And, oh, God, now we've lost our lead actor. And dare I say it, and I may say this in future appearances, I think that's why losing Eccleston, it sets the series back because we're not able to finish that idea of him healing.
Yes. Yeah.
And so when he regenerates, David Tennant's Doctor has to carry that. And really he has to carry it all through his tenure. Mm. And it's not even until Matt Smith that we're able to start to get over that guilt.
Well, I mean, it's explicitly got over in Day of the Doctor.
Exactly.
It takes all that time. Maybe it was supposed to, but I certainly agree with you. I'm really pacing myself for season two, and now we'll be watching it, imagining what would Eccleston have done.
I also think losing Billy at the end of season two has a big effect on what he planned to do as well.
Was she going to stay? Was that the plan, to stay longer? Well, I thought 2 years was good.
I don't think that his original intention was to change cast every year, which is what he ends up doing.
Yes.
And that series Bible says we're not even going to mention regeneration because it just might not come to that. And then he discovers that he's going to be doing, you know, what happened during the Hartnell era or the Troughton era where you have a change of cast every year. And I think that the thing that he intended to set up doesn't come off. We'll get more of that when we talk about season two.
But yeah, I mean, this is the story that made me miss Eccleston in advance. It's like, oh God, the end is coming and I'm really not ready for it. I feel like I've just met you kind of thing. I'm just getting to know you. And suddenly the party's over and you're getting on a plane tomorrow, you know, is how it feels. And it's like, you know, what might have been. And what might have been is Eccleston, who feels like he doesn't get happiness and doesn't get comedy right, is that, appropriately enough for an episode entitled The Doctor Dances, he doesn't set a foot wrong in this story. You know, he pitches everything perfectly from the vulnerability of kind of saying to Rose, hey, look, I am capable of that. I am capable of romance. I am capable of caring. Right through to his utter triumph at the end.
Mm.
And, you know, Rose even comments, look at you beaming away like your Father Christmas. You know, Rose comments basically, I've never seen you this happy. Yeah, it's powerful. And if we hadn't known that he was going, thank you, BBC Publicity Department, for totally cocking that up. Mm. If we hadn't known that he was going, how happy would we have been? Because that's the thing, this whole season has that undercurrent of knowing that he's a mayfly. He's going to be gone soon.
How did he get on with James Hawes? How was all of that working out?
We don't know, but eventually, I think the plan had been originally for Graham Harper to do the final recording block, and he said that he wanted Joe Ahern. He was pretty insistent that Joe Ahern should do it instead.
Yeah, okay.
I think James Hawes does a good job of this. Back for the Christmas Invasion. He's good, I think.
Yeah. I think the only director, actually two directors that Eccleston apparently didn't get on with, well, we know he didn't get on with Keith Boak. And I have heard that he also didn't gel well with Brian Gant, who directed The Long Game.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I haven't heard anything particularly about him and James Hawes. But, yeah, there is that whole thing of he pretty much he wanted Joe Ahern to direct everything. He got on really well with Joe Ahern. And even 5 years ago when he was talking about not doing the anniversary special, he said, I might come back if Joe Ahern directs.
Mm.
And, of course, we've heard from other sources that Joe Ahern will never direct again for Doctor Who because basically his partner said, it's me or Doctor Who. Because Eccleston demanded him back on the show, he was incredibly overworked and incredibly overstretched.
Right.
And, you know, it's a bit like there are certain media companies that Rod said to me, you're not allowed to work for them again. You're absolute hell when you're working for them. It's a matter of if I had to take a job with him, he would disapprove. He wouldn't actually react all that badly. But it is that kind of thing of, you know, jobs can affect you in that way.
Oh, gosh, yes.
And because you're off in Cardiff doing it as well, presumably away from home.
That's a long way from Newtown for Brendan.
And especially with the finale being apparently such a tense environment and nobody really talking to anyone and having to have your three leads shot entirely separately. Yeah. I believe it was this episode that was shot at the same time as The Long Game. And also, if you look at The Long Game, entirely studio-bound. If you look at this, lots of location work. If you look at The Long Game, there's lots of scenes without Chris and Billy.
Yeah.
If you look at this, in the first episode, Chris and Billy are separated for ages. So it wasn't, as the Dr. Light episodes would be, you know, shot entirely at the same time, but there was a lot of overlap to allow for that kind of scheduling. Boomtown next week will essentially be the Dr. Light episode. And again, they split everyone into three.
Mm-hmm.
So you can have essentially one third of the usual workload for each of the leads. And here, of course, I think it's more the traditional Doctor Who structure of Doctor and Companion get separated, Doctor and Companion come back together later in the story and compare notes.
Yeah.
At the time, I knew that Jack was going to become a regular. I don't think they were shy about that because the casting of Barrowman was very heavily announced because, of course, he was such a name and remains such a name, you know. And, of course, from our perspective, we heard, oh, my God, you know, we've got an openly gay man playing a regular on Doctor Who. That being said, that final scene is very much shot like, you know, this character is going to make a sacrifice.
Mm.
And because we've had several sacrificial characters over the course of this year, you know, we had Pete, we had Clive, we had Harriet Jones, who was willing to sacrifice herself, but she's fine. You know, we have Suki. It's played like, this is this week's sacrifice. But the thing is, the Doctor's already said, no, everyone lives this time. So he has to come in. And that wonderful pullback shot I remember watching that thinking, and we're just going to see it explode now. And oh, that's so sad. And then we pull back through the doors and Glenn Miller's playing again.
And we're in the TARDIS.
And we're in the TARDIS. And the thing is, the Doctor's not even hanging out saying, come on, come on. No, he's like, no, I'm dancing with Rose. You can come in if you like.
Do you think, is that mattered? I think it looks so good that I just want to, in my head canon, they just built the two sets next to one another and he just sort of walks through from one into the other. I think it's so great. It's so well done.
Yeah, yeah.
And again, sort of just Moffat-y and clever.
No, I'm pretty sure they did do that. They did attach that set to the TARDIS outer doors because that whole TARDIS console room was a standing set with the exterior doors outside. It's basically the toy that they later released and is out again, Richard. So if you missed out on getting it last time. Yeah.
I'd like to make my own, but this one is quite fiddly, all those curves.
Yes. Like literally the only reason I haven't bought it is I have the Matt Smith one and it's been sitting in the garage for 6 years because I don't have any room for it.
We don't.
Yeah, it's a beautiful shot and a beautiful moment, but also it sums up the relationship between the three characters as it's developing because, you know, when he steps aboard the TARDIS, Rose immediately wants to dance with him. But with this threat, the Doctor needs to assert himself. And, you know, he needs to assert himself as I'm the man in charge, but he does it by swing dancing around the console room. You know, he doesn't go, I've got a bigger gun. He goes, look, yeah, you can do all that. Well, I can do what you do too, mate. And I feel a bit uncomfortable with that, but I think I'm meant to because the last shot after the Doctor takes Rose for a dip is he looks over at Jack and we end on the Doctor looking at Jack and sort of challenging him. And again, it's this promise of what could have been if Christopher Eccleston had stuck around longer. It's deliberately setting up that there might be a bit of tension between these two for Rose's affections and for leadership.
You know where that was also going to go? The red bicycle.
Bicycle when you were 12.
The next story was going to look at how the Doctor had been manipulating Rose's timeline to make the perfect companion.
This was Paul Abbott's rejected script. So Paul Abbott, who created Shameless, who was a TV writer in the UK, sort of comparable to RTD in his sort of influence and stuff, and they tried to get Paul Abbott to write for the show, but it didn't pan out.
But he was such a fan of Cartmell.
Yes.
I'm glad they didn't. It was just a bit too silv.
Yes. Really. Yeah.
Or what ends up happening with the Moffat characters who, you know, they're all women that the Doctor has met when they were small children.
Yes.
In a sort of somewhat creepy way.
In an Elon Musk-y sort of way.
Yeah. And the dilemma of that story was going to be, does Jack tell Rose? And I'm really glad they didn't do that as well because it just feels wrong for the Eccleston Doctor and Rose relationship in that Eccleston is a Doctor who's learning to be with other people again. And I think that if they had introduced a storyline where he's manipulating his best friend into what he wants, that is an evil action.
Well, it's
that's a more sort of Moffat thing. In RTD's world, the companions are people that we like and identify with, people who we hope, you know, leave the Doctor better.
We trust in happenstance and coincidence. Yeah. Actually, RTD has faith in the human condition.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, whereas the Moffat characters tend to be much more science fiction-y and much more high concept.
And much more 2D comic-y.
Well, a little alienating, I think, for that reason.
They're like kind of the DC universe where everyone's a bit flat and grey and with lots of dark shadows. Yeah, it's not really where I want to be going. But luckily, that hasn't happened.
All right, so it's part two, which means that it's time for picks of the week.
Hurrah.
So my pick of the week, it is on YouTube, but it's an audio adventure.
Ooh.
It's called Doctor Who, The Ninth Doctor Adventures, Cold Open. And it's a fan-made production with a very, very good Christopher Eccleston impersonator.
That's Jodie Whittaker.
Yes.
And the idea is it happens just before the first series.
Ooh.
They've only released one episode so far called Cold Open, as I say. It's 33 minutes long. And for me, it kind of feels like the audio visuals plays, which I know I've mentioned before, which were the forerunner to the Big Finish plays. It's very professionally done. It's quite a simple story. It's only got a few characters, But as I say there, Eccleston is very good and I highly recommend it. So we'll include a link for that on the website.
Oh, sounds exciting. Assuming BBC Enterprises hasn't made them take it down.
Oh, it's been up for 4 months. It's still okay. There. I can see it here on my screen. So we're okay for now.
Listen to that right now. Well, my thing's always antecedents, so I'd just throw a few at us. I didn't mention Greer Garson last week in Mrs. Miniver, which is William Wyler's lovely 1942 piece on how the Brits were coping with the Blitzers, but it's set in Cornwall, in Judy Cornwall. And it's the film about which Churchill said that was worth more to us than 100 warships. He cites this film as the one that brought the Yanks into the war as much as anything else. Look, really, is it that good? Well, it's Greer Garson and it's William Wyler. But there's some other ones. There are better films. There's Fires Were Started. Put that light out. Yes, it's about the AFS, the Amateur Boys, but he uses the real boys. And there's some moments in this at the bomb site that really reminded me of that film. So that's Humphrey Jennings from 1943. There's Next of Kin, Thorold Dickinson. Didn't they have lovely names just then, which was all about careless talk costing lives. But my favourite, it's called Their Finest, and it came out only 2 years ago, 2016. And the director was Lonnie Scherfig. And it stars the podcast's own Gemma Atherton. Did you see it?
No.
It's about a girl during the war who is sort of on her own. And we don't know exactly why she's on her own or how she's got to be where she is, but she's terribly clever and competent. And she ends up writing propaganda or writing the scripts. But she also ends up working within anyway, I won't spoil it for you. It's a really lovely piece. And even though it comes after this, I'm thinking, oh, come on, you. I mean, we can't just cite this show as being an influence on later films. However, there's some lovely little tonal moments. It did really well. I think it got a BAFTA.
Mm.
So, yes, fresh from her Bond fingering podcast.
I just remembered there's something else I wanted to pick of the week for this story, and that is Attagirl.
Oh, yes.
Yes. Yeah, sorry. I know. How could we not? Yeah.
What were we thinking?
So it's one of the Big Finish originals. They've come up with 7 original ideas, like not based on any other TV show or what have you. So the original concept comes from Louise Jameson, and it's based on the Women's Air Transport Auxiliary. So it was the women who were moving planes where they needed to be in the war, flying without radios, so they would be shot at by their own people, so they had to fly under a certain altitude so the British Army would know, oh, that's probably an ATA girl. I think it's something like something between 1 or 3 in 10 of them died while flying, crashes, got shot down, etc., etc. It's 4 1-hour plays, absolutely beautiful and elegiac and heartbreaking, all directed by Louise Jameson, all written by women such as Helen Goldwyn and Jane Slaven, who have done Big Finish for years. Yes, and I think currently available for $25 or $30 on download. They may do more. It's labelled as Series 1, so there may be more tales.
It's really cracking.
Yeah, yeah. What is so amazing about it is they keep the sound design and music to such a minimum to try and emulate the style of an old war movie. And there are men in the plays, but it's mostly the stories of these women, not exactly based on true stories, but based on things that happened. And I think Louise actually said there are 2 characters in it who really existed. And, you know, we've tried to be as loyal to them, but most of them we've made up, we've put together real people. But it's kind of like the things we're talking about, all of these things happened to someone. Yeah, continuing the sort of very strong Nancy in this story, go listen to Attagirl.
Oh, well, I feel like mine's going to be a little bit of a letdown. Last time we had picks of the week, my pick of the week was television because...
Give it a try.
It's really good. I can recommend it. We've spent a lot of time covering the wilderness years by not putting out an episode of the podcast for several months.
Yes.
And while that happened, of course, 4 new Target books came out, all of which you've probably read by now. But given that we spent a lot of time expressing what were probably fairly minor criticisms of Stephen Moffat, his novelization of The Day of the Doctor is everything that you would expect it to be. It's smug. and it's sort of complicated, but it is so wonderfully funny and so terrifically humane and so tremendously well done that mm-hmm. it's definitely worth a read. So I think all four of them are great. The two of them that are set in series one and two are also available as audiobooks read by Camille Kadoury and, you know, definitely worth a listen. But I would really strongly recommend cool. The Day of the Doctor, which is probably the sort of the last Doctor Who-y thing that we'll get from Moffat for a while. Listener, we've saved 1940s London, so I'll be off to threaten Cardiff in 2006.
And like it hasn't got it coming.
And we'll be catching up with some old friends on the way. We'll see you next week for Boomtown. In the meantime, you can find us at flightthroughentirety.com, Flight Through Entirety on Facebook and Apple Podcasts, and at FTE Podcast on Twitter. And if you would like us to spend the evening with you sitting on the couch watching a Bond film, why not grab one of our James Bond commentary podcasts over on Bondfinger? That's bondfinger.com, Bondfinger on Facebook and Apple Podcasts, and at Bondfingercast on Twitter.
Can I just say, Moonraker is really good, but probably don't listen to it while you're drinking anything. Yeah, drink something beforehand because, yeah, you don't want to have a mouthful of liquid when we get to the space station.
How many times have I heard people say that?
It's gravity.
Until next time, may you find, to your surprise and delight, that you have one more leg than you actually thought you had. Thank you very much for listening and good night.
I love it when that happens.
Yes, no referencing Rolf Harris. Good night.
That was Flight Through Entirety, starring Nathan Bottomley, Brendan Jones and Richard Stone. Theme arrangement by Cameron Lamb. Strings performance by Jane Allberg. This episode, Sofa of Extreme Comfort, was recorded on the 22nd of July 2018 and released on the 29th of October. And of course, you can hear more of this sort of nonsense on Jodie Into Terror, a Doctor Who flashcast in which we chat about each new episode of Doctor Who Series 11 mere hours after it airs. That's jodieintoterror.com and Jodie Into Terror on Apple Podcasts. Should we just talk about the final scene with Jack?
Yes.
I've got nothing to say. No. Let's try that again. So let's just talk about... do we have anything to talk about the ending or not?
I need to think again.
So remember, he's like talking to his computer and ordering a martini and talking about waking up with his... with his executioners. Lovely couple, stayed in touch.
It's when you realise that Jonathan Frakes could have easily done the entire piece. But with a beard.
With a beard. He wouldn't have been able to sit in chairs, though, the way that Jack does.
No, this is true.
I think at the time, I knew that Jack was going to become a regular.